Lord, two moments of silent prayer. We do count it a privilege, our Heavenly Father, to again come together as a people interested in learning Thy Word. We're grateful for this opportunity because we realize how important it is in our lives. May God the Holy Spirit enlighten us, we ask in Christ's name. Amen. All right, we begin this evening with point 8, the timing of active and passive living. I think if we were to review very simply what active and passive arrogance involves, you might want to summarize it with one simple sentence, and that is, the active arrogant gets what he gets at the expense of the active or the passive arrogant. The active arrogant individual always has fun at the expense of someone else. His pleasure is derived from maligning, belittling, or doing something to the individual where he receives self-gratification. In, of course, the marriage situation, that can be either the husband or the wife. I use he because that is grammatically correct. You never use she in proper grammar. We do have today, for example, people who are trying to pacify the women's lib by saying he and or she, but he is correct in grammar, even if you are referring to a person who is other than a male. So when I use he, I'm certainly not referring to the male of the species, but using it generically or properly grammatically. The passive arrogant, of course, is that individual who gets involved in all kinds of things responding to the active arrogant. I made suggestion last evening that that's what happens oft times in a cult situation. The man who is in charge will simply tell the people that he is their savior. Those, of course, because of guilt or emotion or because of, and I think this is probably the one that plays the important part, and that's iconoclastic arrogance, or role model arrogance, where the individual presents himself as being something other than what he really is, and weak people tend to respond to that sort of thing. Now, in a marriage, again, it can be either the male or the female. In the case of the male, he becomes a bully and bullies himself upon his wife simply because of the fact that he either wants to express his masculinity, which is a poor way of doing it, or somehow wants to impress her with his superiority. And, of course, what he is doing is very successfully showing his inferiority. Then, on the other hand, you have a nagging wife. A nagging wife would be the active, arrogant individual in the relationship, and the man, if he's a real man, won't stand for it too long. You see, it's like the analogy that is drawn in the Scripture. When the sin nature takes control of the soul and the emotion, which is likened to the right woman in the relationship, begins to become aggressive and starts dictating to the right lobe, the right lobe then shuts down. And so a real man will shut down. He will not take aggressive activity on the part of his woman, with the exception of sex. And this is all that I have. I'd appreciate if somebody would be so kind as to take care of this evening. All right, here, as we know, the emotional pattern of the soul, and it's designed to respond to the right lobe. When the right lobe controls, there's an appreciation, and the emotion is perfectly under subordination to the information that's located within the right lobe. This, of course, is like the right man in a marriage relationship. This is like the right woman. She responds to the aggressive activities that are offered to her by the information contained in the right lobe. In this case, doctrine, an appreciation of doctrine. The result, of course, is an appreciation of life in general. Now, occasionally, however, the sin nature takes over, and when it does, it starts into the emotion because it wants to reverse the order. It hates doctrine, and so the emotion then begins to become aggressive. This is likened to the backup of the soul, emotional revolt, the principles that we have studied in the past, with what happens to the kidneys when they begin to back up urine, and of course it eventually destroys the liver. In this case, the right lobe simply shuts down. Then it is sheer emotion. And you've probably seen this. If you haven't experienced it already, if you haven't been married that long, you will. There is nothing more furious than an emotional woman without thought. Now, she just goes ranting and raving around the house, screaming and yelling and falling into that usual always never. Occasionally, they'll go back and bring up things that happened 30 years ago in your relationship that is absolutely irrelevant, has nothing whatever to do with your present situation. Remember, things of the past are past. Okay? There's no bearing whatever. It's the present that counts. And you see what happens, emotion becomes disoriented to space and time. And so it is not thinking in the present. It is thinking of the unrealistic expectation of the future. And that's what it boils down to. Because you see, when a person is in emotional revolt, their expectation is in some form of grandeur. They're not living realistically. They're simply living in an illusion. And then they have to revert to the past to somehow destroy the area of the present. That's the only thing they can do. They can't face the present as a current reality. You say, well, this person is completely disoriented. Obviously. Why? Because they're being controlled by their emotion rather than by the doctrine resident in their soul. When doctrine controls your life, you are sensible, you are reasonable, and you do not have inordinate ambition nor unrealistic expectation. You are not forming iconoclastic situations. There's no role model arrogance that you've fallen into. You are completely devoid of any cosmic activity. Why? Because you are living in the power sphere. You're operating under the ministry of God the Holy Spirit, and He controls your life. So whether it be the ladies who get upset or the men who get upset in the marital relationship, realize something. Whenever you start going back in time and trying to bring up something that occurred in the past and have it have some meaning or relevance in the present, that's not the Spirit of God working. That's got to be straight from the flesh. Why? Because in most cases, and I would say probably in 99% of the cases, the very fact that you had any meaningful relationship between the time of that action to the present, there had to have been some kind of a resolution of that particular problem. Even to the extent, let's say it was a legitimate situation and the person rebounded. Okay, now they're forgiven and you're bringing out something that God has forgiven. And there's the challenge, you see. So now what is that person doing? In their emotional revolt as a result of the sin nature, see, the sin nature always wants to play God. The sin nature always wants to sit on the throne of your life. And yet, being crucified with Christ or co-crucified with Christ, the sin nature is considered dead. And the divorce has been legitimized by virtue of the fact that you are identified with Christ's death through the baptism of the Spirit. You are now free to be married to another. That's the whole teaching of Romans chapter 7. You see, in Romans 7, Paul makes it very clear that as long as the sin nature is as actively alive as it was in your previous condition as a non-believer, you are not free to be married to Christ. Why? Because there would be a legal adulterous situation. But if the sin nature dies, and then he declares within the context of that passage, you are dead to the sin nature. You see, you're the one that's dead to the sin nature. The sin nature hasn't died. The sin nature is still active. It's alive. It's running around looking to see whomsoever it can devour. In most cases, the most devouring that is done is to your own soul, because it attacks first in the area of emotion, because that is the most vulnerable. See, that's the weakest point of your soul, is your emotion. Why? Because without the proper dictation of the right lobe, it has no content in and out of itself. The emotion cannot think. So what does it do? It responds. It always responds. And then, of course, responding to the sin nature says to it, now look, you take control. Well, it's completely out of place. And now it's trying to run the activities of the soul, and that would be like getting an infant and putting them as president of Chase Manhattan Bank and saying, what is your suggestion for tomorrow's itinerary? And this guy comes up with that da-goo-goo. That's the best the flesh can do. It plots, it schemes, it counterplots, it counter-schemes. It is constantly involved in the intrigues of the flesh. And since it has the multitude of choices in either cosmic one or cosmic two, it can just simply opt for any one or a combination thereof of the cosmic system. And isn't it marvelous that you can know that? You can actually pinpoint it. Of course, most won't agree with it when they're in it, because the sin nature is not going to say, yeah, I'm wrong, I'm out of line, I'm dictating to the emotion, I know the emotion is my slave, but I'm going to do it anyway, and I know I should be in fellowship. They don't admit that. The person thinks they're right. Why? Just as the unbeliever doesn't realize they need to be saved. They have to hear it from somebody. How shall they hear except someone what? Tell them. That's our responsibility, back to Sunday morning and Sunday evening's message. Now, as far as the timing is concerned, timing is so important in life. It is marvelous, really, that we are creatures of time. Sometimes, we can't even avoid using the term in our normal vocabulary. We are so regimented by time. We get up at a certain time. We retire at a certain time. It may vary, but when we say to someone, I'll meet you, and they'll say, what time? We wear it. We wear that regimentation, for the most part, on our wrists. Some who are in intrigue and spy and CIA, they'll have various watches. It used to be that you could always tell somebody that was involved in foreign intrigue, because back when they didn't have the large chronographs where you could find out what time it was any place in the world. Now, of course, you just push a button. It gives you Athens time and Rome time and Hong Kong and Swahili land and so on. They used to wear varying watches, and they'd look at it, and you figured either the guy is going to say to you, hey, you want to buy a watch? Or he's involved in some kind of foreign intrigue. But we are really creatures of time, but that's good. When a woman finds out, for example, that she's pregnant, it's marvelous that she has some time. Right, ladies? Wouldn't it be awful if you said, oh, Mr. Period, well, tomorrow, and, whoa, be awful. Yeah, you didn't even get a chance to say, you couldn't even tell your friends. So this way, you have time. The body adjusts. It has to. The entire pelvic area has to enlarge. And the bones have to move. And the tummy has to stretch. And oft times, you carry those scars for the rest of your life, called stretch marks. And so on. Eventually, you get to the point where you no longer have a navel. Junior has taken over, you see, and you find that you no longer have a will either, because it's his will or her will, and you decide you're going to sleep, and it becomes active. Activity contingent, of course, on your mental condition and retiring, whether you realize it or not, through reflex motility. and so on. So you have time to adjust. I mean, imagine reducing it down to even a period of a week. You know, first boot, and then boot, and boot, and then boom, 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 bing, bang, bing, bong. You say, well, that'd be nice, you'd be over it. No! Your husband would be going crazy. This way he can adjust. And you can start putting money away and so on and all the rest that's involved. And painting that room that you use for sewing. Now it's going to be for hissing or hurrying, you know, that sort of thing. Or crying. You can call it the ballroom. You can even put over the door that famous 1 Corinthians 15 passage. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed. That was, by the way, a verse that was used over a nursery in a Baptist church that we heard about one time. So timing is important. And you notice how things are scheduled in time. And when you reach a certain age, you're considered an adult, unfortunately. I differ with that greatly, but nevertheless, the problem with being my age is that you look back and you say, 18? Adult? Nah. But when I was 18, yes. And you say, 25? Adult? Nah. 35? Nah. But see, you can't do that. And I have to catch myself occasionally and realize that some people are 40 years younger than I am. And they're considered adults. Scary, isn't it? You're almost, in fact, you're more than three times their age. And I suppose people who are in their 70s, like Bob Thiem when he was here, he called, we were talking on the platform, he said, by the way, John, how old are you? And I told him, he said, you're still a kid. He said, I'm 72. And I said, you look it. No. No, I didn't say that. I said something like, oh, that's too bad. No, didn't say that either. I just said, oh? I really don't know how to respond to that. So? That's what I should have said. So? But he considered me a kid. Okay, my stepdad is 85, 86. Almost, you know, that's close to 90. Well, it is. 4 years. There he goes. See, his mother was, I think she was 98 or 99 when she died, and I think his father was about 99 or something, and. They couldn't speak English very well, but boy, they could sure tell you amazing stories in Italian. I mean, it was really great. He used to tell us about his legs. Those are snakes, by the way. His legs in Argentina. You realize, of course, that that side of the family are not Greeks. They're Italians. We'll forgive him for that. But what are Italians anyway? They're just renegade Greeks that dropped the S and left the I on the end of their names. All right, timing then. Point eight, timing of active and passive living. A, no one can live his life totally in active or totally in the passive sphere. You will find that you have a tendency to shift. And when to be passive and when to be active is a matter of grace orientation and the utilization of the problem-solving devices. Actually, grace orientation is one of the problem-solving devices, so the utilization of the other problem-solving devices. In other words, sometimes you are correct in being passively virtuous. Now, we're talking obviously about passive virtue as opposed to active virtue. Then in other areas, you are actively virtuous. A good example of that would be when I'm learning, I'm in a rather passive, virtuous condition, being filled with the Spirit, hopefully, as I am studying, especially when I'm learning from somebody else. I put myself in a passive situation. Passive meaning the subject, speaker, produces the action of the verb. Me, I, the receiver, receives the action of the verb. Whether you realize it or not, I am active, you are passive at this point. Now, when you teachers go in and teach your prep school classes, you are assuming the active role and they're assuming the passive role. So there are times when you are active and there are times when you are passive. And it's obvious that you better know when you're to be one or the other. Let me give you an illustration. I'm up here teaching and you decide all of a sudden that you're going to become active. Well, that's uncalled for. And my active will be stronger than your active. Or if you want to put it simply, my act will be stronger than your act. I'll just tell you in no uncertain terms to sit there and shut your face. Simple enough. Like I did that woman that was here that morning that decided that she would say no way after I'd made a point of doctrine. Out loud. Sitting right where you're sitting, Nick. And don't let it continue, however. She just decided that she didn't agree with what I was saying. No way! I said, what? So I excused myself from the rest of the group and I proceeded to chew her head off. Why? Because I'm mean? No, I'm playing the active role during this time. You're playing the passive role. Now, when you leave here, you can be as active as you want. You can get in your car and just, be off, down the road. That's your business. Doesn't pay, by the way, because then another actor comes on the scene with the blue lights and siren, strange things like that, little red flashing ones in the back windows, and then you become extremely passive again. Very passive. All right, the wisdom of spiritual self-esteem knows when to use active virtue and when to use passive virtue. And so, as the point implies, it is a matter of timing. And if you are passive when you should have been active, your timing's wrong. And if you are active when you should have been passive, your timing is wrong. Point B, grace timing originates from grace orientation. You know, there's that verse that says there's a time for everything. There's a time to rejoice. There's a time to be sad. There's a time to be happy. There's a time to smile. There's a time to empathize with another individual. There's a time to cry. It says weep. Well, when do you cry? Generally, when there is a sad situation. Let's say you're all at a funeral. And everybody's crying. Well, it would be rather absurd for you to walk in there and start giggling. I mean, everybody's standing around, and it's very sad, and they have their heads bowed, and tears are streaming down his face. All of a sudden, this guy comes in, splitting his sides, rolling in the aisles. You look at him and say, that guy's a wacko. Timing's wrong. Now, on the other hand, if you're listening to a comedian, I'll never forget this. We went to Disneyland or Knott's Berry Farm, and my daughter Robin and I, all of us were there, but apparently it struck us more than it did the others. And Robin and I started laughing. Who was the guy? David Brenner. Okay? And he got funnier, and I don't care what came out of his mouth. He could have belched and I would have laughed. I was at that point where you get into almost a hysterical thing. Well, there was a combination of, we were both in the aisles. Literally in the aisle. I was bent over. I hurt laughing so hard. Tears running down my... I wasn't weeping. Okay? Well, you see, there's a time for that too. There's a time to pray. There's a time not to pray. There's a time to have Bible study. I'll show you an area of active arrogance in our last church. There was a guy that, this deacon that I keep telling you about, who carried his, that guy who carried his resignation undated in his pocket all the time. So if I ever said anything that he didn't like, he'd just write in the date. It was already signed. And then he'd hand it to me. And like a stupid fool, I would take it and accept it. He'd leave, and then he'd come back, and you'd say, what'd you do then? And I'd make him a deacon again. And that was stupid. And he did that about four times. Then finally he decided he was going to the mission field, and we had a big party for him and everything, and we gave him a leather briefcase, or somebody gave him a leather briefcase, and then he never went. Came back again with his leather briefcase this time. Well, he used to sit in the back, and when he got to the point where he was bored with what I was teaching, or because of his subjectivity, it didn't agree with what he particularly would like to hear that morning, why, he'd get his Bible out and his notebook, and he'd start studying in the back of the auditorium. I mean, just... And then he'd have the unmitigated gall to come across a passage he didn't understand. And I get this. He raised his hand. Now, this was during Bible class, which was acceptable. And he'd say, I was just reading in Galatians chapter 5, and I'd say, stop right there. Now, this didn't make points for me, by the way. And he'd say, yes. I'd say, what are you doing in Galatians 5? Well, he said, it was a side study I was making. I said, well, we're not in Galatians 5. We're in Revelation 3. So I'm not going to answer any questions that you have on Galatians 5. Well, you know what happened there, Jerry. I got to the point where I just knew it was next thing is, you know, resignation time. When I'd walk in on Sunday morning, the first thing I'd do is I'd eyeball him. If he'd come toward me with firm look, I knew he was ready to resign. Or he had a serious problem going on somewhere in the church. If he was smiling, I was relieved. And I would generally... You fill in the blanks. The wisdom of spiritual self-esteem. Notice that. The wisdom of spiritual self-esteem knows when to use active virtue and when to use passive virtue. Again, it's a matter of timing. Point B then, grace timing originates from grace orientation. Spiritual adulthood is the status of effective grace timing in the function of active and passive virtue. And it takes cognitive self-confidence, cognitive independence, and cognitive invincibility, all of which we've studied of late, to know when to use active virtue and when to use passive virtue. How to avoid active arrogance and how to avoid passive arrogance. You see, a lot of people will begin listening in passive virtue and shift to passive arrogance. Say, how do they do that? They get out of fellowship right in the course of their sitting in class because something that I've said didn't agree with their famous theological breakthrough that they had somewhere else in the past. See, that again is that past business coming up. This guy, going back to him again, was a classic for running up with his open Bible. Every time I'd see him like this, I'm in trouble. And he had it all marked up, and apparently he was a student. The problem is he didn't know the original languages. So he relied on fundamentally the King James, which he thought was inspired, and the footnotes of the old Scofield Reference Bible, which to a degree are accurate as far as they go, but they don't go far enough. You know, everything is good. When I was a child, I spake as a child. I used to have a Scofield Reference Bible. I haven't opened one up and checked the references in probably 15 years. Why? Because I've outgrown the Scofield Reference Bible. What am I going to do, go back in time and argue again his misinterpretation of Genesis 6 and Revelation 3, or 2 rather? He admitted himself that he didn't know the original languages. Same with Lewis Sperry Chafer. Some of you don't realize that Lewis Sperry Chafer was probably one of the greatest theologians of his time with regard to breakthroughs on things of grace orientation. I was first introduced to the concepts of grace from Lewis Sperry Chafer's book on grace. I'd only been saved a year, and I got a hold of this book. Man, I digested that thing. That was for me. And who, of course, was Bob Thieme's professor but Lewis Berry Chafer? But you see, to his dying day, he still believed in infant baptism. From his Presbyterian background, he would not give that up. And yet he was also a very strong advocate of dispensational theology. You say, well, how do the two even come close? And they don't. And what some people did is they said, well, he believes in infant baptism, and they threw out everything he said in comparison. You can't do that. All of us have quirks, except me, of course. Theologically, I mean, it's just perfect. Yeah. Oh, I learn something every day if I study. Something new. Something that's modified, not changed, not altered to the point where I reject the one and accept another. No, I'm past that. Modified to the point where it's fine-tuned. There's something added to it which makes it richer and more enhanced. Okay? It's like going from monochrome to a VGA. For those of you that understand computers. You'll think, I thought everybody was in green and white, you know, after that. The green and white screen gets old. Amber and white, you know, grays. Now you have 16 shades of gray. Big deal. And then the EGA, no, CGA came out. Then the EGA. Then VGA. Can you imagine seeing something on a screen that looks exactly like a photograph? That's the clarity coming back at you? Well, when you were a child, you thought as a child. You know, some of you played with Barbie dolls. You thought that was great. That was the greatest thing you ever had. You never thought you'd ever outgrow it. Some of you ladies didn't. You're raising them now. It's okay. No problem with that. That's the gift that God has given to you. You switch from one to the other. See, guys never play with dolls, and, well, although I know some that did. I was not one of them. Strange people. You know then, because of the uses of these various ideas of doctrine, how to avoid active arrogance, how to avoid passive arrogance. But you see, again, having said all of that, it's all contingent on what? Choices. Timing and choices. Look, you make the right choice at the wrong time, and it's wrong. You know, you can do a beautiful 1.5 off a diving board, but there's no water in the pool. Yeah, I mean, you can have all the form you want. And crunch, it's the last one you'll do. Then, of course, swimming in a pool can cool you down. But if there's lightning all over the place, you don't want to be in a pool, it's a worse place. You know, it's a conductor. Or playing a game, or you're out there and you decide you're going to rake skim the leaves that are being flown into the pool by the winds, and the lightning's flashing all around, you're holding this great big aluminum lightning rod. Like that dumb fool. Really, he's a fool. Ben Franklin. What an idiot. Go out there and fly a kite holding a wire in his hand. Whoa! And he puts a key on it. And so what he got in effect was really a static discharge, not the direct. If he got a direct charge, it would be, the story would be told about this foolish old man who was left as a pile of ashes in the middle of a field. How about you golfers? You get out there and it starts raining and lightning and thunder. What's the one thing you don't do? Well, you don't go around holding your metal clubs or waving them in the air like this, see? And you're a living lighting rod. And you're going to be lit, too. And you're not going to be alive anymore. You'll be a dead lightning rod. The amount of people, by the way, that are struck by lightning out on golf courses is phenomenal. hide under a tree, and then the tree crushes you. Things like that. Of course, you know that it's when it's your time to go, you're going to go, whether you're frosted or creamed or drowned or smoked or blown up or melted or whatever, or just sleep and never wake up. I know most of you think that would be nice at 94. But that's not the way it's going to be. Point C, when it comes to sin, I love this phrase, by the way, when it comes to sin, we are never helpless. When it comes to grace, we are always helpless. Now, here's the point, and this is what I want you to get down in your notes. We are absolutely helpless in the status of marriage. If anyone is ever going to have a successful marriage, we must recognize that we are helpless and that God has provided everything so that it can work. As soon as you get the idea in your stupid little brain that you're able to do it, that's when you're going to fail. Because listen to me, look up here, I'm going to make a statement, and I want you to get it. What is a marriage? A marriage is the invention of God. And everything that God invents, He provides the means of execution for its success. Marriage was not the invention of man. Now, without grace, a marriage cannot work. And without God, you cannot have grace. So when it comes to grace, we are helpless. When it comes to sin, we don't need any help at all. Do you need any help when you're sinning? You ask somebody to help you. Hey, help me sin. You do. That's the easiest thing in the world for you to do. That comes naturally. But marriage is not a natural union. Did you understand that? It's not natural. Why? Because you've got two people trying to live as one people. And don't tell me that isn't difficult. Look at Arizona, the highest divorce rate per capita probably than any other place in the United States. Why? But people can't get along with people. So what does it take? Number one, it takes you to realize that you are totally helpless in the success of your marriage. And that since God invented marriage, then it's up to Him to provide the wherewithal so that it can work. And He has. And you know what it's called? Grace. Now, having said all of that, let me read the point again. When it comes to sin, we are never helpless. When it comes to grace, we are always helpless. We are absolutely helpless in the status of marriage. Therefore, if we are ever going to have a successful marriage, we must recognize that we are helpless and that God has provided everything to make it work. Now, that ties in what we've been studying. God has provided all the answers in both active and passive virtue. Point D. God has revealed in His Word how to function in this synchronized system of grace timing. And by the way, the only timing that's worthwhile is grace timing. When to say what you say, when to do what you do, when to act when you act, when to be active, when to be passive, all acts of virtue. But you see, for the average person, That isn't even known, first of all. It isn't even known that there is such a thing. So they're acting on impulse. They're acting on passive virtue, or rather passive arrogance or active arrogance, depending upon which role they particularly are playing at that time. That's not for a successful marriage. That's what destroys a marriage. That's what destroys a relationship. So point nine, principles for a successful marriage are the results of virtue in marriage. Now, I'm going to make a statement that I want you to take in the context of the next point. It's in the form of a rhetorical question. And I want you to answer honestly to yourself, obviously, because it's rhetorical. I don't demand an answer, even a response, like that. You don't even have to do that. All you have to do is answer to yourself. Here's the question. Does intimacy, generally intrude upon privacy? The answer should be yes. Right? I didn't say who you were intimate with. I'm just saying that intimacy is generally intrusive on somebody's privacy. Correct? However, here's the point. Intimacy does not destroy privacy when you have active and passive virtue. Because the intimacy then is an exchange of both active and passive virtue exchanges. That may sound redundant, but I think you got the idea. Now, let's take it a step further. But intimacy does destroy privacy where you have active and passive arrogance. You know, I often wondered, and this goes back quite a few years, but I often wondered why a woman would even suggest that she felt that she was being raped by her husband. Okay? Did you get the idea there? Why would a woman have the sensation that she was being raped by her husband? Answer: he was in active arrogance. And therefore, her privacy, the intimacy intruded in her privacy. And what is rape? Rape is an intrusion on the part of the intruder in the privacy and life of another, namely a female. I understand it fully based on doctrine, but at that point I had great difficulty with it. I said, hey, they're married. Wouldn't that be your first choice? They're married. How can she claim rape? How can she even think that she was? Now, in the light of this, when is a woman submissive? When she's being treated by active virtue. She then assumes the position of what? Passive virtue. See it? But when the husband, the male, or reverse the roles if you prefer, if the female is now actively arrogant, what's his response? Retreat or counterattack? And how do you counterattack with active arrogance? Passive arrogance, which becomes, in your sense, active arrogance. Fights. What is really a fight? It's two people in active arrogance. And here's the whole point of this thing. You can only have, in two people, you have to have one who's active and one who's passive. And there lies the rub. Who's responding to whom? Neither one are responding. And by the way, if you put it in perspective, who are they really responding to? Themselves. I know that may sound a little deep to you, but it's not so deep. It's rather simple when you stop to think about it. In some cases, when you're arguing with a woman or a man who's unreasonable, you might as well look in the mirror. You might get better response. At least you'd be impressed with your own facial expressions. Certainly not because of the blank face you see on the other side. Now, I've always told you people this, and I'm going to repeat it again. Best way to get out of an argument, number one, is like what Mitsubishi suggests, or whoever it is that suggests it. Don't put good brakes on a car and so on and so forth to see how well it will crash into a wall. Put good brakes on a car to prevent the accident. Okay? You know, Volvo goes in and whoosh and says, see, guy only got a broken nose. They suggest what's the best way to have a safe car or a safe trip or whatever is to avoid the accident. Well, what do you have to do to really relate in marriage to where you don't have arguments? Avoid them. Simple enough? Avoid them. For example, if she puts something in front of you that you have great difficulty in detecting, you're not quite sure what it is. All right? Don't push it away and call it crap. She is not going to like that. That will cause a serious problem. You might ask, you know, very, by the way, you know, very tactfully now. And if you're smart, ladies, and present him something that is hard to detect, you might tell him ahead of time what it is. Okay? This is, you know, it's a new dish. Give it a name, even if you have to make it up. Well, what's in it? You might have to make that up, too. When I was dating my wife, I'll never forget this, I had never had eggplant. Okay? You know how they, I don't know if you're used to this, but the Iowans, they bread it, and then they fry it. Okay? And they serve it kind of like, well, anyway, I looked at it, and I said, well, that's pork chops. If she'd have told me it was fried eggplant, I probably would have laughed. That'd have been a good way to get rid of me, see? Serve me broccoli, fried eggplant, and squash. And what else don't I like? Cooked carrots. That would have been it. And string beans on the side. That'd have done it right there. No meat. No meat. And said, this is what I'll fix you every day of our marriage. Man, I'd have been out of there. Ooh. You'd have seen 136 Ford going down the road at Mach 2. Yes, I had a 36 Ford coupe, by the way, with a rumble seat. No, we never rumbled in the rumble seat. I don't even think I got in the thing. I used it for storage. Parts and tools and nuts and bolts and screws and so on. I think I've seen that on the road, by the way. Of course, that goes back 30 years ago, and I can't hardly think that that's the only 36 Ford that survived. You have to avoid confrontations. You know, in life in general, you want to get in a fight? You can get in one. Right? Go into a bar. When I was in the service, we used to go into the bars. We drive in from Williams Air Force Base. We get as close to Goodyear. We have to get close to Goodyear because that's where the Navy hung out, see? And then we go in and we say, nice and loud, I smell barnacles. I says, no, that's not barnacle. That's Navy. And then you hear, hurry over the corner, see? And say, of course, we'd add a little bit more to it. I smell anchor poop, you know, something like that. And then they'd start in, you know, that's jet fuel or something, see? And there's too much prop wash in here or something. And it wouldn't be long. What would happen? We'd start in. Thumpa, thumpa, thumpa. And then we went into Mesa, and we started dating the Mesa girls. That's where I met my wife. And the Mesa High School kids didn't like that. So whenever they'd see anybody that even resembled somebody that was either in uniform or in fact was in the military, they'd thump on them. So we'd go in with carloads, with chains and baseball bats and hammers, and we were looking for a fight, and we would just go down the road cruising. All right? And you get in fights that way. But now, if I'd stayed home and slept in my bunk, I would have never gotten into trouble. I never did. I was a very cautious individual. Whenever I saw, I even smelled trouble. I was out of there fast. The other guys got busted, but I was always out of there. How come you know? Guess it was my hearing. I could hear the crunching of the leaves or the sirens way far away. Well, guys, I think I've had enough. My knuckles hurt. I'm leaving. And then all of a sudden, you know, they'd swarm around, and I was just putting out. Then, of course, I met my wife, and everything changed around. I became Mr. Nice Guy. I don't know why I told you that. It's really none of your business, but I figured it happened so long ago. My wife could always bring it up and say, see what you did so many years ago, and start giving me a hard time. I'd say, after 35 years, see, the one thing nice about getting old, let me tell you this. One thing nice about getting old, your memory goes. And see, that's nice. Because you can't bring things up of the past. You can't remember things of the past. Okay? You did such and such and such and such. Later on, that's why after so many years, it's a beautiful relationship. You can't go back and say, remember when you did such... gone. Of course, I still remember. But my wife never did anything that I had to remember that would have caused me to say, you did such and such and such and such. Except for this time and that time and that time and that time and that time. Which is so irrelevant. So irrelevant. Principles, then, are very simple. You must have virtue in that marriage. No virtue, no marriage. You see, love is contingent on grace. Why? Because grace begins in impersonal love. You see, you can't have impersonal love without grace. All right, what does grace say? Grace says, I love you not because you're lovable, but because I am the subject. You are the object, and it's my worth that's on the line, and I have the honor and integrity, and therefore it is grace that loves you, and I love you through grace. And you see, once you get to that point where it's where you're sending out those signals of hatred toward each other, there's no grace orientation in that. You've become sub-grace oriented to the point where you don't even have impersonal love for that individual. And you should never be reduced to that. Which, by the way, suggests that if you get that far, it suggests that you may not have ever had impersonal love to begin with in your marriage and in your relationship with that person. If it starts right, it starts off with impersonal love. And you see, you can always fall back. Let's say you get to the point where you say to yourself, hey, this thing is unreasonable. We are not compatible. We made a serious mistake. You can do it wisely and calmly. Instead of going back to the first century and bringing up things just to prove your stupid point, or sitting there nagging at each other, or playing, Silent Sam. Are you irritated? No. Tight-lipped. And of course, he doesn't know. He has no idea that you're irritated. He's sitting there with your face all screwed up. If you only looked at yourself in the mirror at that point, maybe you change your facial expression. Do I really look that bad? Or just burst into tears for no reason at all.
I'm so unhappy.
And who are you feeling sorry for there? Certainly not the one that you're unhappy with. And the real problem is, quite often, listen to this carefully, the person is unhappy with themselves. See, oft times people make the wrong decisions in their marriage relationship. And when they do that, the next little game they want to play is called rationale or rational justification. Let me justify through my own particular rationale why I did what I did. And so then you start a campaign. Well, the reason I did what I did is actually I don't love this individual. And I really never did. And so you sit down with the person and say, I just want you to know I never really loved you. That is straight from the horse's rear. Okay? With all of its expellations. That's a nice way of saying it, isn't it? Not explanations. Horses' rears have no explanations. They only have expellations. In active virtue, the man's volition has two directions in marriage. One, impersonal love for all mankind, which gives him the capacity for personal love, and then personal love for his wife, which is the function of the husband in marriage. See, it all began with a simple relationship. The simple relation, I say simple relationship, simple as far as the complexities of marriage are concerned, it started with a thing called impersonal love. I've got to go back and see if I can find a space here. Here's one. It started off with impersonal love toward, directed toward man. That is mankind. It just so happens, by the way, this may be a little deep, but that woman that you're going to marry is a part of mankind. See? You've already learned to be impersonally loving toward that because of your grace orientation. Now, eventually that impersonal love is converted to your right woman to be personal love. And if you get to the point where this no longer exists, you can still fall back on this and have a relaxed mental attitude and then just decide that the thing's not going to work. But you know as well as I do that that's not the way it goes. That's not the game people play. And that, by the way, proves the condition of the one or the other with regard to where they are in their spiritual status at that point. If the man is perfectly relaxed about the woman who's acting like a damn fool, then she, of course, is the guilty party and out of fellowship, and at that point, at least, negative toward doctrine, and is not utilizing the one principle, the one mandate dictated to us as believers, love the brethren. It happens to be that that person is more than a brother. It's her husband, but what else? If nothing else, he's a brother in Christ. Huh? By the way, did somebody have the idea that when you get to heaven, you're not going to see your ex-wife who was a believer? Or you're going to have separate little compartments? Now you say, well, we'll have new minds and the former things have passed away. Thank God for that. You notice, by the way, that heaven is heaven because the former things have passed away. And when you bring up the past, you're living a life like hell. Why? Because hell is always a remembrance of the past. Always. That, to me, is the greatest pain of hell, remembering the past. And what's the one thing in the past that is inescapable to the unbeliever? That they rejected Christ as Savior. So you see, by application and by illustration, the one who wants to bring up the past cannot be living a life as they would in heaven, their position. But the one who discounts the past and says, the past is the past, forget it. What's important is now, the present. You know what that's called? That's called living a day at a time. Impersonal love toward all. It just so happens that your wife happens to be one of the all. And then personal love toward one. In this case, specifically, with all the intimacies involved. And then mix that by virtue of your spiritual self-esteem, by virtue of your autonomous situation, by virtue of the fact that you're applying the problem-solving devices,
The fact that you're applying your maturity to that relationship, you have a phenomenal marriage. Not just like Joe next door. Or a little better than Joe next door. Who wants that? Again, God is the inventor of marriage, so it takes God for it to work. And everything worked beautifully as long as Adam and Eve, our first parents. See, God performed the first marriage. Adam, do you take Eve? Yep. Who else could he take? But see, that's the point. Right man, right woman, you see? Only man, only woman. There's a principle established there. It's phenomenal. And then Eve, do you take? Yep. And by the way, if she'd have said no, there'd have been another one right on the scene. So you see, she was in great jeopardy at that point. All right, in the ceremony, I'm assuming there was a... Now, he says, you want this to work? Yeah, all right. Everything is free. You can do anything you want except one thing. And our parents couldn't do it. They couldn't do it. You say, well, they had outside interference. But they also chose. They also chose. So don't you try to rationalize. And you'll notice that Adam immediately tried to rationalize. Who did he blame for his problem? The woman that you gave me. You know what he's saying? You know, God, it's your fault. If you hadn't given her to me, I wouldn't have had this problem. You notice the Lord, by the way, didn't even respond to that? Yeah, sure. Went right over it. Yeah, no response to that. See, he wasn't going to sit there and argue with Adam. He was going to say, hey, Adam, you got it all wrong. You made your decision. Mm-mm. He was going to have to find out, and he did. But you see, the beauty of the thing is, his next decision was, what was he going to do with the salvation that God provided as a result of the wrong decision that he made previously? And at that point, he made the right decision. And that's why we have to make the right decision subsequently. That's why it's up to man individually. And that's what a successful marriage is all about. It's a series of decisions on a daily basis. Yeses and no's. And the yes must come out at the right time. And the no must come out at the right time. Because if you say no when you should have said yes, problem. If you say yes when you should have said no, problem. Of course, then maybe one of you, some of you may be the uncertain type. You go through life with a maybe. Well, it could be. Maybe. Or this one. I despise this one. I guess. You guess what? What are you guessing? You know what a guess is? Big question mark. Don't use that phrase. Sometimes, do you want to go? I guess. Don't say that. Want to go out to dinner tonight? Well, I guess. You know what you're saying? Ho-hum. Oh,